I love carpet. I love desk.
Rick, are you just looking at things in the office and saying that you love them?
I love lamp.
Do you really love the lamp, or are you just saying it because you saw it?
I love lamp. I love lamp.
Hey. 3, 4! 3, 4! 3, 4!
Fun times in Cleveland today!
What is going on? Welcome to another edition of the Exiled Clevelander Podcast. I am Adam Copeland, your host. Thank you, as always, for joining me on the show. Been a little too long since the last show, and I apologize for that, but sometimes life gets in the way of these things. But I suppose that the benefit of not having a show in a while is there's a lot to talk about when you finally do come back. And we certainly have that with the Browns now, 7 games into the season. The Buckeyes, last time we spoke, were in the thick of the national championship chase. No more now. And a little team called the Cleveland Cavaliers has returned to action. Promised some Cavaliers talk, some real Cavaliers talk for the first time on the podcast. And we're going to do that all in AC's Top 3.
That's going to leave a mark.
The top 3 stories in Cleveland sports.
Milk was a bad choice.
Or at least the 3 he feels like talking about.
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
Story number 1, the Browns at the bye week. Where are we going? Where have we been? I'll tell you this much. If only the Browns could play the defending Super Bowl champions every week, they might have a decent record. In the past 3 years, the Browns have a 750 winning percentage against the reigning Super Bowl champs. They are 3-1 against those teams over these last 3 years, springing upsets on the Giants, the Steelers, and a couple weeks ago on Drew Brees in those New Orleans Saints down in the Superdome. Or maybe the Browns could play a team whose fans ask the question, who day or who dat, every season or every game. They're 2-0 this season. They have their only 2 wins of the season against those fan bases, the Cincinnati who day Bengals and the New Orleans who dat Saints. But here we are at the bye week, the Browns sitting at 2-5. Doesn't look much better on paper than the 1-6 record the Browns had last year at week 7, but when viewing this team this season, just looking at it without any sort of analysis, the team seems to be more competitive. They've had fourth quarter leads in a majority of the games that they've played this year, and they're in the games, they're fighting harder in the games, and that's just generic. You don't even need to look at the statistics to see that, but if you do look at the statistics, they back up the visual things that you appear to be seeing on the field. This team is more competitive. They appear to be playing better. Rushing yards are about the same, 708 this year versus 680 last year, but they've made strides on offense. They've passed for 438 more yards this year than they did last year, which validates, even though there's been a quarterback issue this year with 3 different starters having to play in the first 7 games, that passing yardage validates the decisions that Tom Heckert and Mike Holmgren made in jettisoning Brady Quinn and Derek Anderson from the team. In fact, Quinn has been such a non-factor that Peyton Hillis, with his 13-yard pass to Colt McCoy in the Saints game, now has more passing yards this year than Brady Quinn. So pretty good trade there, I'd say, for Tom Heckert dealing away Brady Quinn to the Broncos and getting Peyton Hillis and a draft pick in return. So the Browns, 438 more passing yards this year. They're averaging 6.6 more points a game, almost a touchdown more per game on offense. On defense, they've allowed 416 fewer yards. Almost all of that, though, is in the run defense. only one fewer yard in the passing defense, 415 less rushing yards. A lot of that, I think, is the improved play of Atiba Rubin at the nose tackle. He has continued to emerge as a very solid player. And the linebacking core has definitely been shored up as well. Chris Gokong, Scott Fujita have been very effective in the middle. And with the Browns still getting beat up a little bit in the passing game, the fact that the run defense so far has been more under control, I think, has been one of the main reasons why the Browns have been much more competitive this year. And when you stop the run, you give up less points. On average, the Browns giving up 5.3 less points a game. So scoring 6.6 more, giving up 5.3 less. That's over 10 points, over 11 points a game in terms of differential from last year to this year. So the statistics do back up what we appear to be seeing on TV or at the stadium every week. We have a more competitive team. Unfortunately, not really showing up so much in the wins and losses column. Only one more win for this iteration of the Browns this year than last year's club. But I think they'll continue to remain competitive this year as the year goes on. They've had those fourth quarter leads. This team could easily be 4-3 if they had held on in those Kansas City and Tampa Bay games to start off the season. Those were imminently winnable games, which the Browns could not hold on to in the fourth quarter. Some self-inflicted turnovers cost them those games. It would be very interesting to see if those games ultimately cost Eric Mangini his job. If the Browns were sitting at 4-3 right now, I don't think there'd be a lot of question about whether or not Eric Mangini was going to keep his job, but I think he is coaching for his job now at 2-5. 4-3 is a much different story. So Mangini's going to be coaching with some desperation, and I do want to give the coaches a pat on the back for their game planning against New Orleans. I've been ragging on them pretty good on the show here. I do want to compliment them for the innovation, pulling out all the stops on special teams with the throw by Josh Cribbs over to Eric Wright, the fake punt, the trickeration on offense with the previously mentioned Peyton Hillard pass to Colt McCoy. These are the types of things you need to do when your team doesn't necessarily have the most talent. And the Browns came in there with a trickeration type game plan and executed it to perfection, came out of New Orleans with a win. So going forward here, we're a little less than halfway through the season. Still 9 games left on this schedule. The major question, and it wouldn't be a Cleveland Browns season without a quarterback controversy. Seneca Wallace has been pressed into duty, as we know, after the first game of the season when Jake Delhomme went down with an injury. And now Colt McCoy, the rookie who was supposed to basically NFL redshirt his first season, has been pressed into action. If you listen to the earlier shows, my feelings on Colt were pretty clear. He did not look like an NFL quarterback in the preseason. And it was not clear he was ever going to look like an NFL quarterback. So when Wallace went down with that high ankle sprain in the Atlanta game a few weeks ago, and it became clear that Colt McCoy was going to be thrown to the wolves in Heinz Field against Pittsburgh, I probably, like many other Browns fans, was not fearing for his life, but certainly fearing for Colt McCoy's safety. But Colt McCoy, as we all know now, showed up in a big way in that Pittsburgh game, kept his composure throughout, was able to make some plays, make some decent throws. Even though Colt was less impressive statistically in the New Orleans game, I think he certainly built off of that game in Pittsburgh where the moment did not seem too big for him. And there's something to be said for that for a rookie quarterback, for any quarterback. So much of quarterbacking in the NFL appears to be about composure, poise, and playmaking ability. The physical tools are important, but physical tools are not going to get you all the way there. The best quarterbacks in the league, Tom Brady, Peyton Manning, they have that poise and leadership ability. And Colt, at least in the early going, in his first NFL starts, I'm not comparing him to Tom Brady or Peyton Manning, but he seems to have that intangible calmness and ability to focus even in the most adverse environments, and certainly Pittsburgh and New Orleans are that. His statistics, he's 32 for 49, which is a 65.3% passing completion percentage. That's first on the team. One touchdown, two interceptions. He did not have a touchdown or a pick in the New Orleans game. He's also averaging 165 yards passing per game, which shockingly, or maybe not so shockingly, given the history of quarterback play on this team, actually is first on the team. So statistically, though he's got a very small sample size of just two games, Colt is actually the best quarterback on this team. But with Mangini facing a 2-5 record and needing possibly to win as many as eight games to keep his job, the main question is going to be going into this second half of the season, who is playing quarterback for this team? In terms of who actually gives you the best chance to win, that's probably Seneca Wallace at this point. He can make some plays with his feet, has a pretty strong arm, fairly accurate, has NFL experience. So from a game-to-game basis, Seneca Wallace is probably your best bet in terms of actually being able to win football games. The added benefit of Wallace also is he's a little bit younger. He could be with the team at least in a backup capacity for the next year or two. And that's why I would favor not even considering putting Jake Delhomme back into this lineup. He's looked pretty bad in his opportunities. In that Atlanta game, he was hobbling around. I'm not willing to completely write him off based upon him being injured and throwing some picks in the Atlanta game. But there's no reason for the Browns to waste valuable time developing a quarterback by throwing Jake Delhomme in there. So I think that Delhomme, even if he becomes healthy, even if he's able to make a full recovery from that high ankle sprain that he now has, doesn't make sense to put him back in the lineup. So the question in my mind is, do you go with Seneca Wallace or do you go with Colt McCoy? I think Eric Mangini's probably going to favor going with Seneca Wallace because he needs to save his job. And Wallace probably, as I said before, gives him the best chance to win on a game-to-game basis. Me as a fan, I think they need to go with Colt McCoy. And I think that organizationally, it makes sense to go with Colt McCoy. So it'll be interesting to see if Mike Holmgren and Tom Heckert sit down with Eric Mangini and say, we think you need to go with Colt here. Hasn't seemed to be Holmgren's style to intervene like that. But now that the Browns have taken off the red shirt for Colt McCoy and seen that he can play a little bit, seems to make sense to for the Browns as an organization to determine whether or not Colt McCoy can be a player. The Browns need to determine, do they need a quarterback in the future? Are they going to have to use a higher draft pick on a quarterback in the future? I wouldn't favor using one, using a first-round pick on a quarterback in this upcoming draft because I think the Browns are so deficient in so many other areas and there's no playmakers right now on offense that could help even a stud quarterback coming in. But the Browns need to know organizationally where they stand at the quarterback position, and you only know that if you give your youngster Colt McCoy a chance. I don't know if he's going to hit it big, flop, or come somewhere in the middle, but the Browns aren't going to know that either unless they give him some playing time. So I'd like to see Colt in there. I think we'll see him at least for one more week coming up here against New England because it doesn't seem like Wallace or Delhomme is healthy at this point. I do have a sneaking suspicion, though, that we'll see Seneca Wallace probably finish out most of the remaining games in the regular season. The other reason to go with Colt McCoy, you want to see how he's going to perform in the winter windy conditions that you have down on the lakefront at Cleveland Browns Stadium. He's played his whole career down in Texas where the weather has been nice. He's never had to face those adverse conditions. And I think you need to give him that type of experience to see if he has the throwing ability to counter the elements. So, again, another year, another quarterback controversy, and that will be the main story to watch in the second half of the season for the Cleveland Browns. Story number two, the Buckeyes bounced from the national championship picture. On the last show, I was joined by LandLoyalty.com, Steve Kaczynski. He was very afraid of this game in Camp Randall against the Wisconsin Badgers, and his fears, unfortunately, came to light. The Buckeyes lost that one on the road to Wisconsin, who played very, very well. And we're not going to do a breakdown of the game because it was 3 weeks ago now, but just a crushing defeat for the Buckeyes, who were beaten all three phases of the game. Jim Tressel, who has always stressed fundamentals, played physical style football, won the battle in the trenches and on special teams, and that's exactly where the Buckeyes lost that game. Special teams play was horrible, starting off with that kickoff return that the Badgers had, and then on both sides of the ball, the defensive line could not get any pressure on Scott Tolzien or stop the run. The Badgers' offensive line just rolled over the Buckeyes' front seven whenever they wanted. And then on the other side of the ball, the Buckeyes' offensive line had no answer at all for Wisconsin. So here we are now. The Buckeyes have won their next two games in convincing fashion against Purdue and Minnesota. Michigan State, which had been undefeated and in charge of its own destiny, forfeited that when it just dropped a game to Iowa. So now Ohio State reclaims its own Big Ten destiny to a degree. They, by winning out, could share in a record sixth straight title. That's a pretty impressive accomplishment, but I gotta say, this year, a Big Ten title, even if it's the sixth straight, it's not going to get it done for me as a fan. I don't know how you feel about it, but for me, it's not going to be satisfying as an end-of-the-year accomplishment, even if they get to the Rose Bowl, which is still possible if there's a three-way tie. Because let's face it, the Buckeyes have no chance of getting to the national championship picture, even though two undefeateds lost yesterday, and even though you only have two BCS conference undefeateds left at this point with Auburn and Oregon. Even if both of those teams lose, Boise State's going to run the table, and Boise State would get in over a one-loss Ohio State team. And the SEC champion, which is probably only going to be a one-loss team, is going to get in over a one-loss Ohio State team. So forget the national championship game. That is out. The best-case scenario is the Rose Bowl. And that's just not going to satisfy me as a Buckeye fan. Call me greedy, call me what you want, but that's why this Wisconsin game was so devastating. Now, this isn't the Buckeyes' fault. This is not Jim Tressel's fault. But fans in Northeastern Ohio, we don't get to experience championships very often. And right now, you look at the landscape of Cleveland sports, and if you are a Buckeye fan, this year, the Buckeyes easily had the best chance to come out on top with the title. And in college football, where you have these four-year recruiting windows, your chance for a national title, if you're an elite program like Ohio State is, comes around maybe once, maybe twice, every 4 years. And this was definitely one of those opportunities with Pryor as a junior, most of the offense and defense returning. You had seniors Brian Roll, Ross Homan, Chimdi Chekwa, Cam Hayward, all coming back on the defensive end. This was the Buckeyes' opportunity, and they are not going to get it done. They are not going to get to be national champions this year. It's an extremely difficult accomplishment to run the table in a major conference in college football. Imagine if the NFL only had a 12-game season, how many undefeated teams that you would have year to year. Very, very rarely would you ever have an undefeated team. It would happen every once in a while, like we saw with the Patriots a couple years ago. But it would be very, very rare. But we ask college football teams to do that every year without even the benefit of a preseason. So it's a very difficult accomplishment, but it looked like this was a year that was going to be able to come together to at least get the Buckeyes to the national championship game. So crushing that those dreams ended at Camp Randall Stadium a few weeks ago against Wisconsin. I will say this. When one of these high-profile losses occurs, Buckeye fans do tend to get into overreactionary mode, starting to blame Jim Tressel, starting to blame Terrell Pryor, and I will take up in defense of both of those individuals. Starting with Pryor, many have claimed, oh, Pryor shouldn't even be a quarterback. He's a freak athlete, but he doesn't have the tools to be a quarterback. Why are the Buckeyes wasting their time with him as a quarterback? They could use him more effectively as a wide receiver. Completely disagree. This guy is an athletic freak. He may never reach his full potential as a passer. He gives you matchup nightmares trying to defend him on the other end. He gave Wisconsin some problems. He is the best solution that the Buckeyes currently have on this roster as a quarterback, and it's not even close. So to question Tressel for keeping Pryor as a quarterback, I think is insanity. He gives the Buckeyes by far the best chance to win. It's unfair to evaluate him, I think, as many fans are, because they're looking at his potential. They're looking at what he possibly could be. And he hasn't reached that. I'll agree with you there. He has not reached that. I think he could be a dominant force of nature at some point, and he's not there. And he may never get there. But to say he's not the best option at quarterback for the Buckeyes is craziness. And what's even more crazy are the people who think that Tressel needs to be dumped because he's lost some big games and he hasn't been able to cash in on a national championship since 2002 when he was basically playing with John Cooper's recruits. Six straight Big Ten titles. That, if it happens, even though I'm not going to be satisfied by it, is historic. No other coach will have ever achieved that. And it takes something. It takes a lot to get a program to the level where you are competing for your conference's crown in a BCS conference every single year. And he dominates Michigan every single year. Hopefully that will continue this year as well. I understand why people are upset with Tressel, but I would ask those people, who are you going to bring in? Who's going to replace Jim Tressel at the Ohio State University, who's going to run a more effective and more respected program than the Buckeyes currently have? I don't think that there's anyone in the country who'd be willing to take the job who would be able to establish the type of program that Jim Tressel has. And yes, he hasn't been able to get over the hump with his own recruits. There have been some disappointments with the offensive lines, which have continued to rear their ugly head this year. But to me, Jim Tressel is the Ohio State University football program, and that is a great thing. Story number three, the Cavaliers roller coaster ride has begun. Strap in, folks. This could be quite an adventure. Haven't talked a lot of Cavs, really any Cavs, on the podcast to this point. And honestly, there were a couple reasons for that. Number one, kind of the jilted lover problem for me. I am still extremely upset and emotional about what occurred in July with a certain player who will not be named and what that has done to the Cleveland Cavaliers organization. And the fact that it has basically quashed the Cavs' chances of contending for a title anytime, probably in the next 5 years. I'm not over it. So it has made it difficult to discuss this team without any actual games being played to focus on. And that brings me to the second reason why it's been difficult. This team is a complete wild card. It's almost impossible to predict until they get on the court how they're going to play, how they're going to respond to this type of adversity which this organization has suffered this offseason, how the new pieces are going to fit together, how Byron Scott is going to coach the whole thing. Going into this season, if you had asked me, I would have said the Cavs could win anywhere from about 20 to 45 games. And you could make a reasonable argument to me that I would buy for the Cavs winning anywhere in between that range, from 20 to 45. And I don't think that there's another team in the entire NBA that you could probably say the same about, where you have no idea if they're going to be really, really bad or if they're going to be potentially frisky and contend for a 7th or 8th playoff spot. I also would have told you before we started that I like the Cavs' chances to be frisky this year. I like their chances to get that 8th playoff spot. They had a very solid preseason under Coach Scott. The NBA preseason, unlike some other preseasons in professional sports, does tend to indicate how you're going to do in the regular season. And even though most of the national media was ignoring the Cavs, I would have told you, based upon the preseason, based upon the things that were coming out of camp, that I'd like the Cavs to contend for that 8th playoff spot. We're 3 games in at this point, extremely early in the season. I got to tell you, though, after those 3 games, I'm not feeling so good about that 8th playoff spot. Now, there's a debate to be had, which I want to have on the show, about whether or not it's even good for the Cavs to be sort of a fringe playoff team. That's a debate, though, we'll save for another day. After these first 3 games, though, I'm not sure at the end of the day if the Cavs are going to have the horses needed to be even a 500 ball club. And it has already been, through three games, a roller coaster of emotion, starting off last week in the first game against Boston, who returned to the scene of the crime at the Q, where they just absolutely blew out the Cavs. It was a certain player's last game in the Cavalier home whites. Hard to believe that that despicable display that went on that night would be his last game in the Cavalier home whites. So it was a very emotional game for the Cavaliers, and they played like it. And despite not having Mo Williams, and despite having a brand new coach, amazingly, the Cavaliers were able to beat the Boston Celtics, were able to take care of business in that first game. And I got to tell you, I don't know if I've ever been prouder to be a Cleveland Cavaliers fan than I was that night. It felt like a playoff game. It sounded like one on television, and it felt like one emotionally to me as a fan. And when it was over, I was all sorts of encouraged about the way the team had played. They had come together, six players in double digits. It was a true team effort down the stretch. They were 11 down in the third quarter, could have given up, but stayed with it and came back against the team that I think is going to win the NBA title this year, the Boston Celtics. And they came back and were able to get an emotional first win. And I thought after that game, you know, maybe this team really does have the chance that I thought they did. Maybe they really can be friskier than most people expected. Well, and then we've had the next two games. And I think it's going to be like this potentially all year long, where you're going to have some highs and then you're going to have some really low lows that we haven't experienced as Cavaliers fans in 6 or 7 years, really. Cavaliers got blown out on Friday against Toronto by 20 and then lost a heartbreaker on Saturday against the Sacramento Kings back at home by 3 points. Some disturbing trends emerged out of both of those games. Cavaliers have lost the third quarter in all three of their games now, which was a trend, unfortunately, that has carried over from the Mike Brown era. They lost it to Boston by 4 points, lost it to Toronto by 14, and they were losing by 8 at the half. So that third quarter really put the Cavs out of their misery and made it impossible for them to win that game in Toronto. Then they lost it against Sacramento by 16. The Cavs were winning by 14 at the half. They blew a 16-point lead in that Sacramento game and effectively lost the game again in the third quarter. That's a disturbing trend. Now, the second disturbing trend, they've lost the rebounding battle in all three of these games. Lost it by only 1 against Boston. They lost it by 13 against Toronto and by 8 against Sacramento. And those last two games, especially disturbing, because even though the Cavs don't have a lot of interior presence, neither do the Kings or the Raptors. So if you're losing the rebounding battle by double digits or almost double digits against teams like Toronto and Sacramento, that's a big problem. Those teams are not elite teams. Those teams do not have elite big men. So by losing the battle, the rebounding battle early to those two teams here, unfortunately, that could be an indicator of bad things to come. Now, I'm willing to sort of overlook the Toronto loss a little bit. They were without their starting point guard in Mo Williams, without their starting center in Anderson Varejao. Going to be tough for any team in the league to win games consistently without two of their top players, as Williams and Varejao are. But this Kings game, even though they were still without Mo Williams, seeing them lose that third quarter by 16 and lose the rebounding edge as badly as they did was very disturbing. Third disturbing trend, the play of Antoine Jameson. This guy has been brutal this year. We're only three games in, but he's averaging only 7 points per game in over 20 minutes a game, 7 points, 2.3 rebounds. He's shooting 7 for 22 from the floor. That's only good for 31.8%, and shooting 4 for 12 from three, and he's shooting way too many three-pointers. Over 54% of his shots, 12 out of 22, have been from three-point range. And this is a guy who's only a 33% career shooter from three-point range anyway, and is most effective working in the post with those awkward shots that he does, the up-and-unders, the floaters,
and he's hanging out way too much on the perimeter. Now, this is a problem that if the Cavs are going to win, they're going to need effective production from Antoine Jameson. And I don't know if it's because he's just getting older and is starting to develop more physical problems, or if he's disgruntled because he's coming off the bench, or if he's just not in sync with Byron Scott's offense. I don't know what it is that's causing this issue, but Byron Scott and Antoine Jameson have to get it figured out, because if this dude averages 7 points a game and 2.3 rebounds, not only are the Cavs going to be really bad, they're not going to be able to trade his $13-plus million salary to a contender, which is, I think, ideally what the Cavs and Jameson would like. So he is a player to watch. The Cavs need to get more production out of. They're counting on Jameson, even though he's coming off the bench, to provide a consistent source of scoring. And that's the fourth disturbing trend. This team, when it needs buckets, doesn't know where to turn. They had six players in double figures against Boston, and they were able to pull away in the end, and thank goodness they did, because when they need a big shot, it's not clear who's going to get the ball. They seem to be lacking some leadership on the offensive end. The player who I think thus far has actually stepped up the most is Booby Gibson. He seems the most unafraid out there to take the big shots when they matter. Hopefully Mo Williams, when he returns, will be able to come in and take over that leadership presence, play with no fear, take the big shots when they need them, and potentially put the team on their back for small stretches. The Cavs aren't going to be able to rely on one player for long stretches anymore. Their offense and their personnel are not geared to do that, but it would be nice if they could have one player to step up for limited spots, and hopefully Mo Williams can do that, because these last two games, and even in the Boston game, there were times where the Cavaliers just didn't, they were completely out of sync on offense, because you have a lot of players adjusting to new roles, and sometimes you just need a guy to step up and take charge, and right now the Cavs don't have that. So those are some disturbing trends. This is going to be an up-and-down season, though. If the Cavs aren't able to reverse some of these patterns that we're seeing, losing the third quarters, losing the rebound edge, not playing effective defense, which is something that they really need to shore up, this is going to be a long, long season. On an individual basis, I've been pretty impressed by some of the acquisitions. I think Ramon Sessions has a lot of potential. He's a slashing-type point guard, but he's got no jump-shooting ability, so he can be easy to defend. But I've been fairly pleased with him, and been pleased also with Ryan Hollins, who wasn't expecting much from him, but he's playing with a lot of intensity on both sides of the ball, has been fairly effective on offense given that he's a backup center, and he's playing more physical on defense on the block than he was advertised as. So I'm happy with that. I've been happy with Daniel Gibson's play for the most part. Everyone else, though, has been fairly erratic. Anthony Parker has had a terrible game at Toronto, looked pretty solid against Sacramento. We mentioned Jameson being brutal. Jamari Amoon kind of is what he is. He's going to make a few shots here or there. He's going to be able to run the floor. And that's another thing I think they need to be doing. Byron Scott talked a lot about running the floor. This team's going to run. They're going to be the best conditioned team in the NBA. Well, they need to run. They need to run more. When they were most effective in that Sacramento game, when they built that 16-point lead in the first half, it was because they were getting out on the break and making things happen in transition before half-court defense could establish themselves. And as I talked about before, if the Cavs don't have a clear number one option in the half-court game, it makes it all the more important that they get out on the break and finish breaks effectively. And when they've gotten bogged down in these third quarters, they have not had any sort of transition game. It does start at the defensive end getting stops, but then they need to push the ball down the court and finish drives before the other team gets their half-court defense set. So it's been a very interesting start to the regular season. I had great feelings after that first game, but here we are 3 games in, and I'm already fearing for the worst. It will be interesting to see what happens to this team after Mo Williams comes back and how much of this he can solve or at least help with. I don't think they're going to completely solve all these problems, but I do think that he will help, especially on the offensive end. But I think we'll know in about a couple weeks if we're still looking at this team and they're having these same problems, this is going to be a team closer to that 20-win range than the 40-win range. And given all that has happened in the Cleveland sports scene, I don't know if I can bear to witness a Cavalier season where they're winning only 20 games. So that'll do it for this edition of the Exiled Clevelander podcast. Hopefully by this time, you know how to get a hold of me. I hope you'll leave a comment at the webpage at exiledclevelander.wordpress.com. Email at exiledclevelander@gmail.com. Twitter, please follow me. Exiled Clevelander, EXILEDCLEVELNDR. Would love for you to follow me on Twitter. Would love to hear back from you with any feedback, comments. Going to be talking some more Cavs as the season progresses, more Browns. And really, whatever you want to talk about, we can make room for on the show. So please do use those avenues for feedback. Always love hearing from you. I will talk to you next time. Until then, thanks so much for listening to the Exiled Clevelander podcast.
Boy, that escalated quickly. I mean, that really got out of hand fast.